This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. All along the Civic Media Radio Network, it's the Matt McNeil Show for your Thursday. Good to be with you, Matt and Patrick here today, 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Guest-free in the first hour. In the second hour, Rob Driesline from Outdoor News is going to join us about some stories he's talking about there. Also, one of the Hennepin County attorney race candidates, Jarvis Jones, going to join us as well, talk about his campaign. That's coming up in the four. Patrick, how are you today?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. It is unbelievably nice out today. This is what summer used to be like here in Minneapolis. It's just perfection. I think it's like 74 degrees. It's been sunny most of the day. Light breeze. Spectacular. And we get days like this because this is what summer used to be like. And you realize how much, you know, when it's, you know, 90, how much we've broken the planet, man. How much trouble we're really in, because I can tell you right now, there are enough people that seem to have complete control over all this decisions that basically will make sure this planet is a roasted cinder before they stop making profits. And that's the truth. And so that's why it is a little nice to see that Manchin must have been taking a lot of grief from a lot of people, or out of fear he'll toxify himself as a potential spoiler vote against Democratic issues later on. His enablers have basically said, you know what, let's get this passed so that you don't, you know, basically get kicked out of the Democratic Party. If God forbid, if they actually win, you know, more seats and they can say goodbye to Manchin, that would be actually quite nice, I think, at times. So, but I hope you're having a wonderful day. I hope it's enjoyable for you today. I got a lot of things I got to get to this hour. I got to start with something, though, that it's a recurring theme on my show, and that is how angry I am at the garbage knowledge, the garbage idea that Republicans care about the troops. Now, I have been a pretty consistent voice. Now, I'm a veteran, U.S. Army. I was in the first Gulf War. And I was furious with the Republicans when they pushed to basically send troops into a country that did not attack us on 9/11 under false pretenses. That's one thing you just don't do. You don't do that to the military. You do not send them under false pretenses into a combat zone, and they did. Got a lot of them killed, too, for Dick Cheney's, you know, goal to try to get rid of OPEC. I have been, as a veteran, very, and I don't think this is a surprise, fairly clean on veterans' issues. I don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican. If you vote for the following things, I will always, I will back you up 100%. Number one, that a veteran can go into any medical facility anywhere and get treated. The idea that that you have to go to a VA hospital, especially when there are some people who are hours and hours away from them. No, it's the least we can do to veterans to allow them to go to their local clinic, their local doctor, and get seen. And as a matter of fact, I would like to see the federal government make that a requirement of a medical license, that you have to see any veteran for medical reasons. And so that even if it's like a high-end skin clinic, that if a veteran comes in because they're concerned they might have skin cancer or something, they got to be seen. That's just that they don't have any option in it. I'd like that. That's number one. Number two, free college at a public university if you serve 4 years. If you serve 4 years, you can get a free 4-year college degree at a public university. That it's the least we can do it's the least we can do as a thank you to those who served. Number three, you know, job placement, job benefits. That they basically, once they graduate, once they want to get back into the workforce, they are offered the training and the job placement assistance that they need to get the jobs that they need. And number four, and this is the most clear, that there is no hurdles to the veterans, or in the case of a veteran who has given the ultimate sacrifice for this country, the family members they left behind, there are no hurdles whatsoever to those people getting their benefits. End of story, end of discussion. I don't care who you are. If you back up those four things, medical treatment at any medical facility, two, including mental health, by the way, two, free college for a four-year public university, three, job placement when they're ready to go back into the workforce, and four, that you do not jerk them around when it comes to their benefits. I've been very clear about that. I mean, if there's a Republican out there that supports that, I will back them up 100%. It is amazing to me that the narrative is out there, because Republicans like to think to themselves, they like to use the military and veterans as a prop. It's a prop. That's it. They don't give a rat's caboose about them. And I'll be the first to say there's been very few presidents who have actually shown me how much they really care about the troops by offering the funding that they need, the services that they need. Very few. But Republicans are notorious. I was, when my oldest daughter was born, this was in 2004, I had a Veterans for Carry bumper sticker on my car. And I was at a local hospital. My wife was there. She had given birth. It was like 2 days later. I'd parked the car. I was walking in to go see my wife and my new baby. And a woman out of the blue, this was kind of a predecessor of what was coming down the line. She screams at me in the middle of the parking lot, "You hate the troops." I said, "Pardon me, what?" "You hate the troops." And she pointed at my bumper sticker for John Kerry. And I said, "Hey, you idiot. I am a troop, you moron. I'm a veteran." To which she just looked at me and turned and walked away. And I unloaded a little bit. It's like, what kind of moron are you that you don't understand the term veteran means they served? And, you know, because I dared to violate her narrative that not one single military person likes the Democrats. That's the narrative they like to run with. But the reality is, and as much as to the chagrin of Republicans, there are a lot of people in the military that are Democrats. There are a lot. And there's a lot of reasons why. And we just got another example of why. The U.S. Senate came up short Wednesday to trying to move ahead on legislation that would provide health care and benefits for veterans exposed to burn pits overseas. The bill from Montana Democrat John Tester, who I like a lot as a moderate, I'm okay with Tester. Kansas Republican Jerry Morin as well, has been bogged down for nearly 2 months. The U.S. lawmakers debated whether to bring amendments to the floor and how exactly to fix a minor part of the bill that stalled the process in the House. On Wednesday, the Senate voted 55-42. Now, once again, they passed the bill, 55-42. Oh, that's right. The filibuster. The 60-vote threshold to allow them to start debating the bill. Didn't get there, because even though the majority of people wanted that bill passed, the Republicans, for some reason, have convinced everyone that this is some sort of tentpole of American democracy. That is bullcrap. It isn't. It is something that they have created. You can't violate this for when Democrats are in control. And when they're in control, my gosh, we're going to just get rid of the filibuster here. And all Democrats seem to do sometimes is, hey, don't do that again. Needless to say, here's another prime example. We're trying to help the veterans, the victims of those exposed to the smoke and chemicals of burn pits, help them, and the Republican Party says no. Now, immediately after this failed, there was a lot of Republicans who were out there saying, if the Democrats didn't try to add all those amendments. No, they hadn't added the amendments. The amendments hadn't been added. They hadn't. This was something very simple. Some members had objected because the federal government would pay for the bill's $278.5 billion cost through mandatory rather than discretionary spending. Mandatory spending includes entitlement programs like Social Security is set into law to affect indefinitely. Under discretionary spending, members of Congress could control the funding each year through the appropriations process. Basically, Republicans love discretionary spending because they can say, I passed a bill, and then the very next year, they go and gut the bill of any funding. And so even though they pass the bill can't even go into effect because there's no funding to hire people to actually enforce the law. There's nothing. So the Republicans love discretionary spending. And if you ever see discretionary spending on there, it's just a garbage thing because you know at some point the Republicans are going to use that and just take all the money and run. Cornyn, the Texas Republican, said there had been an agreement between Tester and Warren for two amendment votes, but Democratic leaders had not even scheduled those votes. Cornyn said the bill, the hope is the further negotiations to limit some of the mandatory spending in the bill, and the bill can pass. Pennsylvania Republican Pat Toomey said in a brief interview that the vote he wanted to address the budget gimmick in the bill that he believes would lead to an increase in spending related to providing health care and benefits to veterans exposed to the burn pits. Toomey said he had no quarrel with the legislation creating $278.5 billion in new spending during the next decade, and we classified as mandatory. Toomey's opposition bill comes the bill separate from the section of the package which authorized $400 billion over the next 10 years to existing spending to be switched from discretionary to mandatory. And the reason for that is to create $40 billion annual hole in discretionary spending under the cap, Toomey says, that and allow that all kinds of spending, who knows what. No, that's not on who knows what. It's on the veterans. It's on the veterans. And this is why it's disgusting, is this is them just yanking spending away from veterans. I'll tell you what, I'll take a break, come on back, because there's more on this I want to talk about. Mark, hold on, I'll get your call in a moment. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Going live on WAUK 540 AM 101 FM, the Shaw, Waukesha, Milwaukee, Devil Radio 92.7 in Madison, WTTN 1580 in Columbus, and of course on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota in Minneapolis, St. Paul. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Thursday. Let's get Mark in really quick. Mark, thanks for holding. Welcome on into the show.
Yeah, not a problem. Thanks for taking my call, and you were hitting one of my points as well, is we should pay for our vets' health care, period.
Period.
I mean, it breaks my heart we see all these ads on, for these private organizations to help vets out. Our government should be paying for that, and that's burn pit thing. It's a crying shame that the government's not, the Republicans aren't willing to support that. But the other thing I saw is, and you probably saw it as well, that attempts on the Republicans to do away with Pittman-Robertson and probably Dingell Johnson as well, because that has provided, endless opportunities for sportsmen, including myself, for hunting and fishing.
Well, and Mark, if I can mention this really quick, that's actually going to be one of the topics we're going to bring up here with Rob Drieselein in the beginning of the 4 o'clock hour, where we're going to be talking with him, because we got a few topics to get to, but that's one of them, that this idea that somehow one of the most effective programs out there needs to be cut is just because, it is the Republicans, just that's who they are.
Yep, that's who they are, because they don't support, they claim to support it, and there's so much that could be done. I mean, I saw it recently in Pheasants Forever over the past a few months ago, how prairie restoration could help do carbon capture, because there's so much in, the grass, some of those grasses. I mean, it extends, 6 to 10 feet below the ground where the root systems go. And, it's sucking down the carbon and storing it down in the soil where it should be, and restoring our prairies and our grasslands.
Well, and Mark, I'm going to step on in there, and I thank you very much for the phone call. I'll save a good chunk of that conversation for coming up here in the 4 o'clock hour. Your points are very valid, though. I appreciate the phone call, 952-946-6205. I want to get back to this here, though. I had someone make the argument to me. It's like, we shouldn't be paying for entitlements. Stop. Shut your mouth. If anybody on this planet deserves entitlements, isn't it the veterans and their families? Is that, I mean, are you really, is your argument saying, yeah, we shouldn't really guarantee that we're going to have all those benefits those people deserve? Aren't you the fools that have been screaming at people about support the troops? Where's your yellow ribbon? Isn't that you? But now all of a sudden, when it's a no-brainer, this is an entitlement we can agree on. The veterans deserve it. And I don't give a flying caboose if there's another $40 billion per year in there. You know what? The veterans deserve it. Stop your whining. Boo-hoo, a billionaire is going to not get the bigger tax cut that you promised them. Shut up and get out of the way. You're the problem. You're not the solution, Republicans. My God. Oh, I don't want to give them an entitlement. You don't want to give the veterans an entitlement. The veterans. God, it just is disappointing. Tester on the floor rebuked Toomey. And by the way, I'll post this little speech that Tester gave out there for holding up the legislation saying veterans would die while waiting for Congress to send the legislation to Biden for his signature. It impacts 2.5 million veterans in this country. By the way, a few more will die before we get this bill passed. And the Republicans don't care. Tester argued that Toomey's objection was about the retiring Pennsylvania senator's lack of trust in his colleagues. And at the base of that argument is, well, eventually we don't want to give the veterans this money. Isn't that the Republican case? Oh, they'll pat themselves on the back. They will find every veterans civic group they can to go get a photo op shaking their hands and saying, I support these guys, while they gleefully cut all the funding for the programs that support those same exact people. That's the Republican Party today.
Yeah, I like the veterans and all, but I also believe in fiscal responsibility.
Screw you. Stop. You are. If you supported Trump, you know how much he added to the deficit? You remember when the Republicans sent us into Iraq under false pretenses? That was a little pricey. We keep subsidizing the oil and gas industry, for God's sakes. How many billions of dollars in profits they're making every year? Stop trying to argue, I'm fiscally responsible. You haven't had a fiscally responsible Republican since 1985. Shut up. This is, as a veteran, don't even try to argue that there's a, well, this government, we don't want to. Yeah, you just don't like the troops. Toomey doesn't like the troops. Cornyn doesn't like the troops. The other Republicans, the 42 that voted against us, they don't like the troops. End of story. Yet how many of them will go back to their communities and those same veterans will be like, hey, it's a Republican. Let's get a photo op for him. Yeah. Well, he sells out your buddies. Sells out you. I tell you, I've said this many times. The modern day Republican voter could walk into their house and find their spouse sleeping with Donald Trump and the first words out of their mouth will be, damn Democrats. Because you guys just don't know any better. They're hurting you. They're hurting you. The Democrats, led by Tester, are trying to help you. And the Republicans are hurting you. It really is that simple. The hell with these guys. Did Bubbles Johnson, did Ronnie J over there, did he basically vote to screw over the veterans? Speaking of Wisconsin, if I may, there has been a little bit of an interesting revelation here. There is a Wisconsin judge on Thursday, said Thursday that a Republican-ordered taxpayer-funded investigation into the 2020 election found absolutely no evidence of election fraud. Zero. But did reveal contempt for the state's open record laws by Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and former state Supreme Court justice he hired. By the way, is there any doubt in your mind that Robin Voss will be shredding every document he can the second he's out of that office? He'll be frantically trying to destroy every piece of paperwork. He doesn't want anyone to see what he's done. Dane County Circuit Judge Valerie Bailey Wren has awarded about $98,000 in attorney fees to the liberal watchdog group American Oversight, bring an end to the circuit court to one of four lawsuits the group had filed. Voss's attorney, Ron Stadler, said he was recommending that Voss appeal the ruling. I will say this, you know, how nice is it in Wisconsin for Republicans to be giving the liberal groups $98,000 in attorney fees? The fees will be paid by taxpayers is why the judge said she was not also awarding additional punitive damages against Voss. Cost to taxpayers in the investigation, including ongoing legal fees, have exceeded $1 million. I think the people of Wisconsin have been punished enough on this case, Bailey Rinn said. I don't think it does anyone any good to have punitive damages placed on innocent people in the state. All the American Oversight's lawsuits stem from the records request made to Voss and Michael Gableman, a former Wisconsin Supreme Court justice and hack, hired by Voss in June of 2021 to investigate the 2020 presidential election won by President Joe Biden, which he did. Voss ordered the investigation under pressure from the loser, Donnie T, who continues to falsely claim there was widespread fraud. Once again, there is no fraud in Wisconsin. Oh, but that's not stopping them. Heaven forbid reality get in the way of a Republican today. Let's take a break. Come on back. More to talk about on this story, plus more. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. It is the Matt McNeil Show on your Thursday, 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Good to be with you today, 952-946-6205. So, you know, once again, this is a judge who is now, another judge has said you have found no evidence of voter fraud. You are not going to convince some of these Republicans that they are just delusional nutbags because they just were so convinced Trump's going to win. He's going to win by 95%. By the way, if I can take a quick step back here, you wonder why in despot countries where evil tyrants control the population, you wonder how the population can look at an election where, you know, supposedly 95% of the people voted for the one guy. It's because they become a country of brainwashed zealots. And that's exactly what you're seeing with these Republicans. And I don't care if they're in high levels of government. These are not people that used to live on the compounds out in freaking Montana or Idaho. These people now are politicians. And they absolutely believe there is just no way that Donald Trump was going to lose. And so when he lost, they were like, they had to have stolen it because if not, then my entire narrative is wrong. You try to tell them, you know, I could help you out with that as your entire narrative was wrong. But no, the reality is these people are just brainwashed. And it doesn't matter that court after court after court has said you can't just bring a cease and desist letter without any evidence there is a crime that's happened. And they keep looking at them like, well, give us all the ballots. Give us an infinite amount of time. And just install our guy into the office until we get back to you. And eventually we'll find the fraud, to which every judge, even the most conservative judge appointed by the most conservative person, is like, that's not how this works. No, we can't. This is called what's called a fishing expedition, and you cannot do that. That's no. You don't do that. Biden's victory of nearly 21,000 votes was withstood recounts, multiple state and federal lawsuits, an audit by the nonpartisan Legislative Audit Bureau, a review by conservative activist law firm, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. An Associated Press review of Wisconsin and other battleground states also found the fraud was so little to have even tipped the election towards Trump. So, almost on cue, the leader of the Wisconsin Assembly's Election Committee called Friday for invalidating President Biden's 2020 election victory in the state, an idea that his constitutional scholars and Republicans legislative leaders have called legally impossible. The fair and honest elections of the cornerstone of our democracy, said Representative Whackjob. Janelle Branchen, No whack job. Can I go with whack job? Whack job. Whacked. I say it like it's a Bond villain. Whack job. Representative Whackjob said in a news release, tyranny is at Wisconsin's door. Yeah, that, by the way, that's a mirror, not a door. Just FYI there, Whackjob. Brangin said she planned to sign on a resolution by State Representative Tim Ramthune, Kook, as I'll call it. Whackjob and Kook, the new hit TV series coming to ABC this fall. Representative Tim Ramthune, to decertify the election, making the first fellow lawmaker to join his cause. By the way, Biden did beat Trump by, funny story, Biden did beat Donald Trump by 20,000 votes in Wisconsin. That there is no evidence of any widespread fraud in the state. But hey, heaven forbid facts and reality get in the way of Representative Whackjob. Like many other Republican lawmakers in Wisconsin, has argued the election was nonetheless fundamentally flawed. Okay, so you shouldn't have been elected? I mean, I just want to verify this. You were fraudulently elected. That's what you're saying.
Well, no, my race was perfectly legitimate. It was the other races that are bad.
Oh, okay.
Ah, you see, that's only a logic a whack job could actually come out and support.
There you go, Wisconsin. Come on, man. Dude, I know in Wisconsin there are far more Democrats than the Republicans. I know they gerrymander the crap out of that state. But if you guys all turn up, they can't win. I mean, you know, Governor Evers, you got Joe Biden. They can't win if you guys show up. And so, yeah, that is a, and by the way, the next Supreme Court race, if there's a Republican that's running, for God's sakes, don't trust them. They're a loon ball. Get rid of them. I think it's that easy. I think it's just, you know, I don't think there's a mystery here. There's not an ancient Greek rhyme or something. No, they're just a lying bunch of jackasses that need to be removed because they're not there for the law. They're there to push Republican policy. And that state, and let me say this one thing about Wisconsin, that state will get a hell of a lot better the second you get a Democratic-leaning Supreme Court. It will. Because then all of a sudden, sanity will come back into the building. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. So I want to revisit a story from a while back. It was a story that I had a lot of people kind of, I guess you'd say, taunting me on, even, and other people I know as well. This is the story of Nick Sandman. Do you remember who this guy is, Patrick? Do you have any idea? He was the kid, the Covington Catholic high school student, who they had the, when he was on the mall for the protest, had the face-to-face with the Native American leader with the drum. You remember that story?
Yeah, now that you know, mentioned who he is, I remember exactly who he is.
Oh, he's snarky. He had that snarky look to him. Not saying he is snarky, but just saying he had a snarky look to him. I'm entitled to my own personal opinion. That's kind of the way it goes. After years of politically charged litigation, former Covington High School student Nick Sandman has lost a round of high-profile defamation lawsuits against five mainstream media companies in the summary judgment stage. That's according to court dockets and an opinion and order signed by the federal judge in the Eastern District of Kentucky on Tuesday. So once again, this is in the Eastern District of Kentucky. Now, I talked about this case, too, and I would have Republicans say, oh, here's another one. Sue them, too. I'm like, wait a second here. I'm just making observations about the case. But these conservatives became convinced that if you actually mentioned Sandman from Covington Catholic High School, that you were somehow, oh, you can't even mention. You can't even talk. How dare you talk about him? You can't. You gotta basically, you can't, you, is that coming out of your liberal mouth? We're gonna sue you into oblivion. That was kind of the mentality they had. Sandman's case is against ABC News, Rolling Stone magazine, CBS News, newspaper and television station owner Gannett, and the New York Times are now officially listed as terminated on the court record. Sandman's ABC lawsuit characterized the truth of the matter as follows. ABC, so this was his accusations against ABC. ABC's accusations against Nicholas are totally, provably, and unequivocally false. The truth is that after the Indigenous People's March was over, Phillips approached Nicholas. Phillips was the Native American man with the drum. And the other students from afar bypassed wide open steps to his alleged destination of the Lincoln Memorial. I don't think that's alleged. that's the destination is the Lincoln Memorial. Specifically confronted Nicholas and never attempted to move past, around, or away from Nicholas, as Nicholas stood quietly for several minutes in a Make America Great Again white hat while Phillips beat a drum and sang loudly within inches of Nicholas's face. The truth is that at the time of the confrontation by Phillips, Nicholas and his classmates, those innocent angels, added that. I just added that. It's me. It's me. I make jokes. Classmates from Covington Catholic High School were assembled in the stairs of the Lincoln Memorial at the direction of their chaperones for buses that would take them home to Northern Kentucky. The truth is that Nicholas and his classmates were bullied, attacked, and confronted with racist and homophobic slurs and threats from violence by the Black Hebrew Israelites, a recognized hate group, before being unexpectedly confronted without explanation by Phillips, an activist who proceeded to target Nicholas while chanting and beating a drum inches from his face, and being flanked by activist companions filming the event in the hopes of capturing a viral sensation that would be used in advance via social media for an ulterior political agenda. By the way, if you have a viral sensation, see a doctor. Phillips specifically targeted Nicholas and placed himself directly in front of Nicholas. How dare he? And I added the how dare he at the end. That's, once again, I make jokes. That's what I do. I comment on life. Senior U.S. District Judge William Bertelsmann noted that CNN filed an early motion to dismiss, which the court granted on July 26, 2019. In that opinion, the court held that none of the statements were actionable for various reasons. Some were not about Sandman, some were statements of opinion, and or some were not subject to a defamatory meaning, Bertelsmann said. In other words, the case had died already once before. They'd already reviewed in 2019 that basically there was no there. And I'll get to why here, because there's an interesting element of Sandman's argument, which is pretty weird. Sandman filed a motion to reconsider. The judge agreed to resuscitate the matter on narrow grounds. At issue with the resurrected case were Phillips' statements that Sandman had blocked Phillips and would not allow him to retreat, the judge wrote. Okay, so this is now, it's gone from the point where, and you'll understand this, this judge breaks it down very well here in just a minute, but he lost his first case, and then basically he's saying, well, Phillips can, you know, that he, it was wrong for saying Sandman blocked Phillips and would not allow him to retreat. Justice required that discovery be conducted in the context of those statements the judge called. Bertelsmann noted that the only evidence filed in the record consists of, one, Sandman's deposition, two, a declaration under oath by Phillips, three, seven declarations under oath by persons in attendance at the incident, and four, a collection of video recordings taken on the National Mall that day. Although lengthy, Sandman's deposition contains relatively little testimony pertinent to the issues at hand, Bertelsmann opined. A little more than a page of bullet points recapped what the judge considered the salient points of that deposition. Among them were the following. Sandman observed Phillips move toward and then through the group of students. Some students moved out of Phillips' way. As he walked forward, Sandman felt that Phillips was trying to intimidate the students by walking right up to them, and when he could have taken several other routes around them. So Sandman felt like he wanted to stand up for his school. At the time, he did not know that Phillips' intent was to go to the Lincoln Memorial. So two things from that. One, Sandman acknowledges he didn't have any idea that the guy was heading for the Lincoln Memorial, which is the large building with the huge statue of Lincoln that's behind you that all those other people are going to. Also, he does make it sound like he wanted to stand up for his school. He's kind of acknowledging that, wait a minute here, I need to stand up for my school. Phillips stood so close to Sandman that his drum touched Sandman's shoulders. His spit was getting on Sandman's face, and Sandman could smell Phillips' breath. The steps were icy, and Sandman was concerned that if he moved, he might slip and fall. This is a teenager, mind you. Sandman felt he was being mature by remaining calm and standing his ground in a tense situation. So he's acknowledged and he stood his ground. Sandman can see how Phillips might have perceived that Sandman was trying to block his path. So now we get to the point where Sandman is acknowledging, oh, yeah, I can see how the guy, put two and two together there. It seems like, he might have thought I was trying to block him. There was room for Phillips to keep walking if that is what he wanted to do. Sandman did not feel that he was blocking Phillips because Phillips gave no indication he wanted to move forward. Instead, he locked eyes with Sandman when he was still several feet away from him, and he planted himself directly in front of Sandman. Phillips did not take even the slightest step in any direction to attempt to move. Sandman is not sure if he moved a little to the left as Phillips approached. Now, this is important. Sandman is not sure if he moved a little to the left as Phillips approached. He either adjusted his footing and or the people around him shifted as well. This is your okay, because I think this, to me, this is his own deposition. It tells me he's kind of seeing to the point that he might have a problem here. I'll get back to that in a second. And at one point, Sandman felt that he was blocked from moving because of the crowd around him, although he had no reason to believe that they would have moved if he had asked them to do so. They wouldn't have moved if they would ask to do so. So you kind of get the point from Sandman. I'll get to the other point from Phillips here and why this is absolutely a joke in just a moment. It's the Matt McNeil Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Listening live on Double Radio 92.7 in Madison, WTTN 1580 AM in Columbus, WAUK 540 AM and 101 FM, the Shaw and Waukesha, and AM 950 Minneapolis, St. Paul. It's the Matt McNeil Show. So getting back to this, once again, this whole case has now been dismissed. The case of the high school student that basically blocked the Native American activist on the mall. At least the defamation suit has been dismissed. Now, we heard from Sandman. Sandman was the kid. Sandman basically, admitted that he was standing at first school. He admitted he didn't realize that he was trying to go to the Lincoln Memorial, which Sandman was standing in front of him to try to get to. He acknowledges that he acknowledges, oh yeah, he could see how he would be that Phillips, the Native American activist, might have perceived that Sandman was trying to block his path. And then he also says there's this little interesting part here, because I think this is the part in the video which becomes a trouble for him, which was, did he actually shift himself in front of Phillips? He says he's not sure if he moved a little to the left as Phillips approached. He either adjusted his footing. He said, I just adjusted my footing. I didn't move in front of him. I adjusted my footing. That seems to be the argument here. The declaration from Phillips, the Native American activist. He approached the students. Phillips felt the crowd was swarming and surround me. As Phillips began to move forward towards the Lincoln Memorial, students moved out of his way. However, Sandman appeared to position himself right in front of Phillips. Phillips declares, it was very much my experience that Mr. Sandman was blocking me from exiting the situation. It was very much my experience that he intentionally stood in my way in order to stop me from moving forward. Further, I felt surrounded in that space, and I believe that Mr. Sandman did not want me to let me pass. It seemed to me that Mr. Sandman felt he needed to stand there and block my way. Now, mind you, these are off their depositions. This is the bullet points that the judge basically boiled their depositions down, saying here are the main points. Of other evidence, a group of six other witnesses declared that Phillips moves towards Sandman, according to the judge. Those six witnesses were in Washington, D.C. to attend the Indigenous People's March, which attracted Phillips to in the order of test. Only one previously knew Phillips, Bertelsmann, the judge said. Five of the six individuals said that their impression was that Sandman blocked Phillips from moving forward. So you have actually other witnesses saying it sure appeared that Sandman was blocking Phillips. The final witness, a classmate of Sandman's, moved away from the group at the time of the counter between Sandman and Phillips and did not observe it directly. Where are all the there was a whole bunch of kids from that high school. Where did they go? I wonder if their parents said, we don't want anything to do with this. 20 videos were submitted into evidence. Only six were helpful, Bertelsmann said. What a viewer might conclude from these videos is a matter of perspective. However, the judge opined that the following is clearly depicted. A group of six other witnesses declared that Phillips moved towards Sandman, towards the judge. What a viewer might conclude the videos is perspective. In analyzing the remaining legal issues, Bertelsmann said some of the Sandman's legal arguments were without merit. As noted above, the court expressly held what while the allegation of Salmon's complaints passed the plausibility test at the pleading stage and the discovery should have had on the context Phillips statement, the actionability of the statements could be revised on summary judgment, Bertelsmann said. Sandman's insistence that the court cannot now revisit this legal issue is ironic, considering that he vigorously and successfully moved the court to reconsider the initial ruling. In sum, the law of the case doctrine does not conclude the court from reconsidering a new summary judgment legal issues based on the pending stage. In other words, in light of the terrorist discovery, Sandman's claim failed. Specifically, as to the claim that Sandman blocked Phillips from advancing, Bertelsmann ruled as followed. Applying the above legal authorities and with the benefit of more developed record, the court concluded that Phillips' statements that Sandman blocked him and wouldn't allow him to retreat are objectively unverifiable and thus unactionable opinions. Basically saying this, Phillips, the Native American activist, has the right to believe that Sandman was blocking him. And Sandman cannot look at him and saying, I wasn't doing that, even though there seems to be some evidence that in some capacity he did block him. So, and this is, mind you, this isn't a legal argument between Sandman and Phillips. This is against the news media because the news media can have the right to present the other guy's side of the argument. That's the entire thing, is that Sandman's argument seems to be, you can only listen to my interpretation. You can only listen to the way I feel it went. If you report on the way Phillips felt it happened, you are somehow in violation of my rights and I'm suing you because of character defamation. And the problem is that, you know, multiple people on the scene thought that Sandman stepped in the way of Phillips. The video shows it. And there is that one thing about that that shuffle of the feet there. Did he stand in front of him, or as he says, well, I just moved my feet. I don't know what the case is, but a lot of other witnesses said it sure looked like Sandman actually intentionally got in front of Phillips. Judge Bertelsmann then criticized Sandman's lawyers for arguing a premise that the evidence doesn't support. Interestingly, plaintiff's response memorandum on the joint motion for summary judgment argues that blocking is factual because it involves the oppositional portion of two human bodies in a confined space. But as the videos depict, the area where this encounter was a huge outdoor area, not a confined space. Then, thus, the argument failed. Later, Bertelsmann suggested that the press did little more than to report Phillips' version of the events. Phillips' version of the events were opinions, not facts, the judge concluded. So Phillips is entitled to his opinion of what happened. Sandman thinks that he is not, and henceforth, if anyone reports on that, that that's defamation against him. Going back to the judge's ruling, the media defendants were covering a matter of great public interest, and they reported Phillips' first-person view of what he'd experienced, the judge wrote. This would put the reader on notice that Phillips was simply giving his perspective on the incident. Therefore, in the factual context of this case, Phillips' blocking statements are protected opinions. Bertelsmann rationed. This holding moots all other motions before the court. Sandman, who has at times tweeted about the lawsuits he's filed, has not tweeted about the dismissal as of the time of this report. But there you go. Back when I was getting conservatives, you're going to get sued next. I'm just basically talking about what happened. And people are entitled to their own opinion. That's the thing. And this is why this case was a little scary to a point. And I'm kind of glad. And once again, this is a judge from Eastern Kentucky who's saying there's no there. That if there's a conflict between two people, there are going to be differing opinions of what happened. And Phillips' opinion, even though you scream he's wrong, is still valid. And then the media talking to him about his opinion of what happened is also valid. And you may not like that, but that's the law. And so it's time for this. He's there. It sounds like they might try to appeal the ruling. I would just let this go. There's a reason why my gut feeling is that it doesn't sound like many, if any, of your classmates who were all there on the Lincoln Memorial stairs, as we saw the video of that, that none of them seemed to be willing to go testify for you in this court case, or at least they weren't mentioned. It, you know, if you got a lot of money, that's fine, but do realize this. And by the way, I do want to condemn a little bit of CNN and NBC. They settled after the initial case was thrown out. They settled. They should have stayed with this, because at this point now, the truth is this, is that you cannot tell another person their opinion is invalid. They are entitled to that opinion. And people reporting on that opinion, that's also valid as well. In Madison, Waukesha, Devil Radio coming up. Hour 2 in Minneapolis, St. Paul up next. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show, hour number 2 on your Thursday. Good to have you with us. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. A lot of things to get to a little bit later on today. One of the Hennepin County attorney candidates, Jarvis Jones, is going to join us in a little bit. We'll talk about his campaign for Hennepin County attorney. But right now, kind enough to join us is the managing editor and publisher of Outdoor News. Rob Driesline is kind enough to join us to talk about a few stories that they've got in the latest edition here. Rob, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Yep, I appreciate you having me on. Yeah, there's a lot to talk about affecting outdoors and conservation.
Well, and your outlet here, the outdoornews.com, is a great outlet there. Lots of great information out there. I'm going to ask you right now, what's the best lake to go get walleye on this year in this state, in Minnesota?
I'm sorry, to go catch a walleye?
Yeah,
the best lake?
Well, what's the best walleye lake? I want to get a walleye. I haven't had a walleye in a few years because the lake I'm on, it's all bass and northerns, and nothing wrong with them. They're fun, but you love the walleye. So, is there a lake this year that's really is getting out any decent walleye?
I tell you, I'm an old river rat. I grew up, you know, down on the Mississippi River, so you can never go wrong down on the river, in my opinion. I think a lot of people take it for granted, you know, what's going on below Red Wing or even down to Winona. But if you're talking old school lakes, you know, the big reservoirs up north, I mean, Leech Lake is incredible. That's also an awesome panfish lake. And then if you're willing to drive, Red Lake and, of course, Lake of the Woods is having another banner year. So,
is it?
There's so many opportunities. And what's great about Minnesota is there's so many littoral acres out there where you can catch a naturally spawned walleye, not necessarily a stocked one. It's pretty incredible.
Last time I went and did Lake of the Woods, I was going from Rainy out to Zippel Bay back and forth, and we got nothing. And I was like, ugh, it was tough. But you are right. One thing, too, the river lakes and the river south of Red Wing are incredibly underrated. My dad always loved to go fish those down there.
Oh, yeah, the Mississippi rivers. And, you know, what's fun about any river, but especially the Mississippi, is you never know what you're going to catch. I mean, there's big sturgeon in the Mississippi now. There's big catfish. There's gar. You know, you might catch an American eel. Who knows? So there's just, I love the river. I love the Mississippi. Yeah.
Outdoor life is part of Minnesota, that's for sure. And regardless of where your political ideology is, I mean, well, that's, you know, hunting, fishing, we all appreciate the outdoors, that's for sure. You, of course, though, have a little bit of a bit of a head scratcher. This is a gubernatorial year. They got the game fair that's coming up here. Generally, you guys have been able to have a little bit of an outdoor-based debate between gubernatorial candidates, correct?
Yeah, I've been doing this 25 years, and with the exception of, you know, a couple of years, was it 06 and maybe 14, just about every year we've either had a U.S. Senate or a gubernatorial debate out there. And it's been a good little forum to get the candidates on record regarding, you know, some outdoor and environmental topics. And Walls and Jeff Johnson did it 4 years ago. We had a good little crowd, and we're a little disappointed it's not coming together this year.
So what's happening with this? Because, I mean, it sounds kind of like a bit of a no-brainer.
Yeah, I agree. Free publicity, and here's where it sits. And I wrote my column about this. And by the way, I normally don't post my print column on our website, but I am tonight, so listeners can read it if they want it, outdoornews.com/Minnesota, the Minnesota page. Where we sit is, We've been working with the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance to try to put this event together. And we probably first reached out to the campaigns over a month ago, shooting for August 20th. That's the second Saturday of Game Fair to have this event. And to his credit, the Jensen campaign immediately jumped on it and said, we'll be there. But we did not hear back from the Walls campaign. And so I started making some calls saying, what's up? Is this going to happen? And I'm not really getting much of a response from the Walls campaign. Basically, what I'm hearing is that it just doesn't fit with their schedule, and it doesn't sound like much of a priority. And like I said in my column, you know, Walls, whatever your politics are, I think everyone agrees he's a pretty good speaker. He did a good job at this event 4 years ago. So we're all, like you say, scratching our heads saying, why would the governor skip this in 2022?
You know, Rob, you also make an exceptional point about, you know, the Game Fair versus Farm Fest. And, yeah. You know, and Farm Fest, and nothing against it. I mean, I believe in ag issues. I talk about them a lot. I believe in outdoor issues. These are big, important issues. But when it comes to Farm Fest, no one from the DFL really stops. They all go to that. That is a guarantee they're going to be at. And you make a very good point. I mean, about, you know, the likelihood of swinging voters towards the DFL at Farm Fest versus the Game Fair.
Yeah, you and I were talking a little off air about that. I didn't write that, but I have no problem stating that publicly. I think there are more swing voters at Game Fair. I think sportsmen, sportswomen, conservation-minded people tend to be a little more in the middle than a lot of folks in ag country, at least these days. So if I'm Walls campaigns people, I'd be like, yeah, we got to get to Game Fair. I don't know. I'm not a campaign expert. Maybe there's some algorithm telling them, nope, this is where we got to be, and Game Fair is not a priority.
I think a part of it, and from my viewpoint, you know outdoors, I know a bit of the politics. I think part of this is, you know, we just had the money numbers come out. He's got nine times much more money than Jensen. Jensen and Burke cannot get out of their own way with the Roe v. Wade comments at this point, and that's really starting to hurt them. There comes this, and I think it's a false mentality that you don't necessarily have to go on out there and do the political things. If you've got a candidate you feel is, you know, fairly substandard or has some issues that's going to, you know, to campaign with you. I agree with you. And it surprises me, too, because Walls is an outdoors guy. He likes his fishing and likes his hunting. I was stunned when you said that he didn't want to go there. So the only thing I can think of is that he feels as if even engaging with Jensen in any capacity only has more negative consequences than any positive. But I agree with you wholeheartedly. Outdoor issues are not necessarily this far-right thing. There are plenty of liberal Democrats I know who are out there who are big on the outdoors, and so this is a way to talk to all people in the state.
A couple points. One, several weeks ago, the DNR issued a press release saying there will be a governor's pheasant opener. I don't think they had one for a couple years during COVID. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if the governor and his campaign people kind of think, well, we're scratching that. We're checking that sportsman box by having a governor's pheasant opener in October or whenever it is. The other point is, you know, you suggest, well, maybe he doesn't want to face Jensen. You know, and that certainly could be. But to me, Ron Scher and I are the guys who are going to ask the questions at this thing. And we're going to ask some hard questions of Walls. But we got plenty of hard questions for Jensen and the Republicans, too, coming out of this past legislative session. So if I'm Walls, I mean, he knows that. He's got to recognize that he's got some ammunition to go after the GOP on. So, again, coming back to we just don't get it.
And by the way, I once again want to make sure at outdoornews.com, he's going to post this article a little bit later on. And I do have to, I mean, I like Governor Walls. I'm voting for Governor Walls. That's just me. I'm going to vote for him. But, you know, this is to my mind, I agree with you wholeheartedly. This is an easy layup, especially, and we don't have to necessarily get into all these issues that were out there. And we can have you back on to talk about other issues for sure. But there were a few things that were mind-numbing when it came to Republicans and the outdoors in this last legislative session where I'm like, you know, do you guys understand that you're jeopardizing far more than just, you know, politics at this point, and especially with its chronic wasting disease, whether it's you know water quality, air quality, stuff like this. I think that, you know, there's a lot of issues that a DFLer can go hammer home on to give them the strength into a debate like that.
Absolutely. I mean, CWD, we've had a couple just completely partisan votes on some CWD issues the past couple of years where the GOP has voted the wrong way. And then the funding, conservation funding going into the session, the governor and the DFL's budget were substantial for the outdoors. And the GOP came in with almost nothing and pretty much got their way. And in fact, without a special session, there's virtually nothing that came out of the legislative session for outdoors. So, you know, there's a couple strong points that Walls could bring to the table at an event like this.
Rob Driesline joining us right now. Well, hopefully he'll get him out there to this. Outdoornews.com. I want to bring up an article you had from end of last month. And we actually had a listener earlier in the last hour bring up the GOP bill to eliminate the Pittman-Robertson Act, which I'm kind of scratching my head on this one. First of all, why don't you describe to everyone out there, what exactly is Pittman-Robertson?
So I've got to be real careful not to start cursing
okay.
on this one because this really, really upset me. And the outdoor media across the country, from Outdoor Life magazine to Meat Eater to everybody, flipped out when this legislation emerged a few years ago. Pittman-Robertson passed 85 years ago. It's not new. It passed on a bipartisan basis. And what it does is it puts an excise tax on firearms and ammunition. And later there was a similar act that was passed to put an excise tax on fishing equipment, and that money goes to the feds, and then it's redistributed to the states based on their population and their license sales, and it goes to natural resources management. We have some states in the union where a huge, huge percentage of all their natural resources management comes from these federal dollars. Without these dollars, a lot of natural resources would not be managed. You take a state like South Dakota, mm-hmm. they're basically managing their resources with Pittman-Robertson money and non-resident pheasant license sales. That's how they manage resources out in the state of South Dakota. So this is really, really important money. This was something brought forth by industry and advocated by industry. I was just up at Federal Cartridge in Anoka last week, chatting with some of those guys over lunch. They're shocked that there's legislation out there that would remove that. And these are guys who have to pay it, right, who have mm-hmm. to deal with it. They know what a huge success story this is. We've got all the authors on this are from the GOP. There's like 55 of them now. And they are saying that the reason they're doing this is because this is any tax is by definition an infringement. Therefore, a tax on guns is an infringement on the Second Amendment. I'm not sure many of them actually believe that because this thing has been hugely successful. But that's what they're bringing forth. It's red meat. It's a dog whistle issue to throw at I don't know who. I guess hardcore Republican voters. I think any sensible Republican would be against this because it's always had bipartisan support. This is a success story, and the outdoor media universally is saying, what is going on? And by the way, there was a letter. I know I'm going on here. There was a letter back in June because some people anticipated in D.C., lobbyists anticipated this was coming. The NRA signed on it. The National Shooting Sports Foundation signed on and said, we do not support legislation like this. So my point is, even very hardcore gun people are saying this is a really dumb idea.
Well, and the thing which is weird is, I mean, you and I talked about chronic wasting disease and the fact that that's being held up by a very fringe, small, group that legislation to try to address that issue. This is, as you just described, I mean, it's almost like gun advocates who never hunt, which is an incredibly small, tiny group of people. But that is the group that seems to be overriding the hunters. And once again, you can't argue with good legislation. This has been good legislation. There are a lot of states, and I know there's a lot of Republicans who are like, what are you doing? This is, they would have to raise taxes in their own state to offset this because this has been one of those no-brainer, this worked sort of things.
The author is saying he's going to replace it with some offshore oil lease money, which would not be dedicated and would be, wouldn't be properly earmarked. It would be gone, in one biennium. So that's not a solution. I want to be clear. This legislation is going nowhere this year. Mm-hmm. I doubt it would even go anywhere next year. Even if there was a Republican president, I think this would have a hard time passing because it's just that dumb. But nonetheless, anytime something like this pops up, you never know what it's going to metastasize into, and because it really would shut down natural resources management as we know it if it passed. We only have one author on it here in Minnesota. It's Fishbach out in western Minnesota. I have gone after her. My reporters repeatedly have called her and said, what is going on? I finally got a statement from her last week saying, saying this is about the Second Amendment. So she hasn't pulled her authorship yet. There have been four or five other authors around the country who have, but none in Minnesota or Wisconsin. We got this Tom Tiffany in northern Wisconsin who's also signed on.
And Grothman as well in Wisconsin 6.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's crazy because Fishbox District, I mean, if not for those conservation dollars, you're talking about pheasant hunting, for goodness sakes.
Right.
The reclamation of those the prairies to be able to get the grouse, get the pheasant in there. I mean, it's stunning that she can't see the forest for the trees.
Right, right. No. And listen, if this thing had any momentum, I'd be really, really worked up. But even its mere existence is really upsetting.
Rob, this is absolutely a pleasure to get to chat to you with you about this stuff. I'm glad you're here. I want to have you come back on because Outdoor News, as you said, this is not a right or left thing. There's a lot of issues here. We have a lot of fishermen, a lot of hunters in the state, and a lot of people that just love the environment and love the fact that we have this money dedicated to reestablish, you know, native habitats and stuff. I mean, a lot of people can enjoy the outdoors in a lot of different ways. It is not a one side or the other sort of issue, and there's a lot of issues that are out there that definitely I'd love to have you back on the air and talk more about, okay?
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. If I can make one last point, we still have time to pull off this this event at Game Fair. So if Governor Walz and his campaign people are listening, we'd love to still have him come out to Game Fair and participate in a debate.
And if I can piggyback on that for a second here, Rob, Governor Walz, I like you. You're a good guy. I think you do a lot of good things. I follow you forever for the veteran stuff that you've done there. This being said, this is kind of an easy layup, man. Go do the Game Fair. Go talk to a lot of people out there because I trust you. You'll be able to make your points. And as Rob says, it's not just a trap by any means. I mean, I think that you have a lot of strength in your arguments here that will help the DFL cause by going and talking at Game Fair for sure.
Yeah, he did it 4 years ago, and whatever your politics, people will tell you, he did a fine job. Yeah,
I'm going to also make sure I mention here, I'll, if you're okay with this, I'll make sure I link to the two stories you and I talked about here. And as well, if you're out there, you want Outdoor News, go subscribe to Outdoor News. I'll put the link out for that as well a little bit later on. Rob Dreesline. Rob, thank you very much. I appreciate the time today.
Yeah, looking forward to chatting with you again in the future. Have a good evening, Matt.
By all means, Rob Dreesline joining us. We'll spotlight that interview, 952-946-6205. Take a break. Come on back to the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. Love me the suburbs, man. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Thanks to Rob Dreesline. Nice to be able to chat with him. My dad was always a big fan of Outdoor News. And, yeah, I mean, and trust me, there's going to be a lot of issues. Chronic wasting disease, trust me when I say that this is not an issue that the Republicans are winning on with outdoorsmen. And so we'll have him back on a few times to talk more about some of these issues over the next few weeks. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Reproductive rights. I have told you, Democrats, DFLers, listen up. You have a massive money advantage for the most part right now. You really do. You have a massive money advantage, which means most people agree with you, especially the people that are trying to help campaigns. The Republicans have handed you the biggest bat on the bat rack with their overturning of Roe v. Wade. Swing away. I don't want to hear any more of these. Gas prices are overshadowed by taking away people's rights. And they want to take away your rights to women's rights to choose what they want for their own body on the contraception. They want to go after gay marriage. They want to reinstall the sodomy laws to dictate who has sex with whom in their own private bedrooms and how they have it. That is who the Republican Party is. And you think I'm lying? Well, here's the latest one. It is the Prior Lake Republican Tony Albright. Sports abortion bans with no exceptions. It aired Friday on a podcast, Wrong About Everything. This is the the podcast host here. So I assume you're pro-life, the host asks Albright. All the way, baby, with no exceptions, no exceptions. The two spar over the issue for a moment, with the host calling Albright's views horrific and Albright calling the abortion the same. He then points to the story of a 10-year-old girl in Ohio who sought an abortion in Indiana. The 27-year-old man was later indicted on the rape of the girl. Albright first claims the story was uncorroborated and then poses the question to the host asking why an unborn baby should be held accountable for the actions of another person. Wow. So once again, we have to point here. His first stance was, you're lying. That person doesn't exist. Oh, they do? Well, why should the baby be held accountable? I don't know. Why do you want to hold accountable the girl that got raped? That's what you're trying to do. As you try to find some, you know, noble stance on an issue that doesn't exist, for God's sakes. Because a 10-year-old would have to go through a physical and psychological scarring and traumatic event, a 10-year-old, the host kind of replied, to which Albright responds, that's your opinion. Wow. So once again, the pain, the suffering, the potential health crisis, the clear mental health crisis of the 10-year-old, who cares, says the Republican Party. Who cares? A few moments later, the host asks, Are you forced to carry that child to term and give birth? In this case, yes. Albright did not respond to the Bring Me the News folks on request on the interview. After a decade in the House, Albright announced his retirement early this year, is not seeking re-election. The race in Albright's community, the newly drawn District 54B, is between two newcomers, Republican Ben Bakeberg and Democrat Brendan Van Alstyne. Bakeberg, principal of Jordan Middle School, is endorsed by the Scott County GOP, the party which notably endorsed Action for Liberties-backed newcomer Natalie Barnes over Senator Eric Pratt in that Senate District 54. Bakeberg agreed to be interviewed by the news outlet, but he did not respond to the deadline to do so, nor did he provide a written statement. Van Alstyne and other progressive candidates in Scott County were condemning Albright's remarks. The reason why this case of this little girl has gained national attention is because it highlights how extreme anti-abortion laws are when they are applied to the lives of actual people. This little girl's case. That's why the Republicans their first initial stance is that didn't happen. Because even in their own damn minds, they say, well, I'm not really that much of a monster. But when people then say, well, it did happen. Well, I guess I am that much of a monster. Wow. Alicia Donahue, the clinical social worker and DFLer in the Senate race over Lang Albright's district, has said her career has brought been close to people's experiences of race and rape and post-traumatic stress disorder. Politics is how we care for each other, and it's honestly appalling how he lacks any empathy for the child who is the victim in an intrusive, horrendous way imaginable. To expect that child or anyone to be forced to carry and give birth to in a country with the highest maternity mortality rate, affordable health care and child care is inaccessible due to cost, is simply inhumane and intolerable. Michael Broadcorp, our friend of the show, a political commentator and former deputy chair of the GOP in Minnesota, said decades of established law through Roe v. Wade allowed conservatives to ride around with training wheels when it came to talking about abortion. Now those wheels are off. I think it's fair to say that the abortion wasn't on the ballot until Matt Burke and Scott Jensen and to some degree Tony Albright started talking about it this way. The state's largest anti-abortion organization, Minnesota Citizens Concern for Life, worded their stance on a no exemptions and bans like this. I'm not going to go down that road. Broadcorp says Albright had long been seen as a potential candidate for state and federal office. Broadcorp believes now will be a challenging prospect for a politician now. There are no gotcha moments, he said. There are Republican candidates standing in front of a microphone openly talking about their views. It should be also mentioned here really quick that a Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison has said his office will not challenge the recent rulings that struck down many state abortion restrictions, including a 24-hour waiting period, informed consent, and parental notification requirements. Ellison's decision comes more than 2 weeks after a district court judge ruled many state laws redistricting abortion and restricting abortion access were unconstitutional, immediately blocking their enforcement by not appealing. Ellison's move will ensure expanded access to abortion in Minnesota, now a haven for the procedure in the Midwest. Of course, the Republican challengers have gone after him, but the reality is this is I'm glad he's not challenging this. Let them come on out there and say, 10-year-old rape victims have to carry that baby. Let them do that. Let them say, I don't care if the life of the mother is in jeopardy. I don't care if she's going to die. As a matter of fact, wasn't Schultz part of that organization that insisted there had never been a case, or there was rarely a case where a woman's life was in jeopardy and henceforth an abortion was never needed to save her life. Wasn't that, was that what he said? This is the issue. This is the issue. And shame on you Democrats if you shy away from this. This is an issue that resonates with people because, once again, it's not just inflation or crime in Minneapolis. No, you're taking away people's rights. I have two daughters. For 1 month, they've had less rights than women who were alive before them. Trust me when I say they're itching for a chance to vote. Don't sit down there. Don't overthink this. Don't try to be clever. Get out there and say, just simply, I'm not for forcing 10-year-old rape victims to carry the child of the rapist out to term. I'm not for looking at a family of four and telling them, oh, Jesus wants mom dead. So you have to stay, she has to stay pregnant. Yeah, that's got some power. And if you look at me and say, Matt, that's going to upset the Democrats. Or it's going to upset the Republicans. That's going to upset the, they're going to be mad at me. Let them be mad. 70% now, 70% believe Roe v. Wade should be legal. You've got the capital to push this issue. For God's sakes, don't sit there and outthink this. Grab that big bat and go into the election season. 952-946-6205. Let's take a break. Come on back. When we do return, Jarvis Jones is going to join us. Hennepin County Attorney candidate. We'll talk about his campaign. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. The Matt McNeil Show, once again here on your Thursday. Now, we generally have had the Democrat of the day, but we're going to talk about the Hennepin County Attorney's race, which is a non-political race. So this is just the candidate of the day. How about we say it like that? Candidate of the day. Hennepin County Attorney's race, the latest one to join us is Jarvis Jones. He's kind enough to take some time today to talk about his campaign, what his vision would be if he's the Hennepin County Attorney, and how you can get more information about his campaign. Jarvis, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Thank you, sir, for having me on.
First of all, I always start the same way here. Why don't you take some time here and introduce yourself? Who exactly is Jarvis Jones?
Okay. Well, Jarvis Jones, a little background on me. I've been practicing litigation for over 30 years, litigation experience. I also was president of the Minnesota State Bar, over 28,000 lawyers. I'm president of the Hennepin County Bar Association, over 9,000 lawyers. I was also elected twice president of the Minnesota Minority Lawyers Association, an umbrella group of all minority lawyers. So I've been active in the legal community for quite some time. I've been on the, practicing over 25 years, but I also been on the business side. I was a vice president at Fortune 300 company. And so I've been on the business side too. So that's kind of me in a nutshell. I grew up in the inner city of Chicago. I migrated up north. I went to St. Olaf, so I'm a good Umyaya, Scandinavian, even though I'm African-American, and I went to William Mitchell Law School. So that's me in a nutshell.
Well, on the legal side, you've hit every button for Minnesota. Well done on that. I will say that. Why then, you've got your incredibly successful career. You have a lot on your side. What made you say, you know what, with the Hennepin County Attorney's race open, I'm going to run for it? What was your call on that?
I got in the race a little later than some of the candidates. And the primary reason was, I believe we're being given a false choice. And that's between safe streets and treating people fairly. Some people call it treating people fairly social justice reform. So we can call it social justice reform and making sure people are treated fairly in the criminal justice system. People believe right after George Floyd, it was social justice. With crime rising, now it's safe streets. We need both, safe streets and treating people fairly. I believe a lot of our politicians or elected officials really don't believe we can have both. in order for us, what people don't know, growing up in the inner city of Chicago, I grew up in a neighborhood called the Inglewood neighborhood, which is known as the mass murder capital of Chicago. So I know what it means to be unsafe. But what I also, although I very much believe folks who do wrong need to be held accountable. Nothing about me is soft on crime. I also know we got to build relationships in those communities and re-earn the trust of people in that community, or we're not going to have safe streets in our suburbs and surrounding areas. So that's why, because I believe I'm one of the only candidates saying we can do both at the same time, safe streets and treating people fairly.
And definitely, you know, the addressing of public safety is kind of the main issue that all the candidates have talked about here. Your title here, I'm looking at your website and your vision here. I want to get in a little bit more detail here. Public safety with accountability. In your mind, what does that look like?
Okay. When people ask me, I'll be very specific. Well, first I want to say this, and this goes to why I got in race and what it looks like. When people ask me, as you said, it's a nonpartisan race, but Democrats run this town in Minneapolis. I'm saying Minneapolis, not the whole town, but I'm saying a lot. Minneapolis disproportionately is Minneapolis voters. Well, I've been a Democrat all my life, but I think people want both. But people are concerned about crime is out of control. We need, as prosecutors, job number one is to keep Hennepin County residents safe. I unapologetically say we're going to take back our streets. We're going to take back our neighborhoods, and we're going to take back the downtown Minneapolis. And at the same time, with the emphasis at the same time, we're going to make sure all residents, particularly residents of color, are going to be treated with respect, dignity, and fairness. Now, how am I going to do that? Short term, I'm putting in place a violent crime initiative, which works with other key stakeholders in the criminal justice system, which would be the Public Defender's Office, and prosecutors and public defenders usually don't work together. We will. I'll be working with law enforcement, and I'll be working with the judiciary. They will be part of that initiative so we can come up with long-term solutions to reduce violent crime, carjackings, which is a major issue, and repeat offenders. We'll focus on that initiative. That will be my top priority. Now, someone who's came from senior management, how do you do that? You prioritize your budget. I will take a hard look at the budget, how we're spending our money, reallocate money towards initiatives that will reduce crime. Secondly, a lot of people don't know, but there's about 100 attorneys on the civil side in the Hennepin County attorney doing civic work, contract work, other type of work. Well, many of those attorneys are going to come over to the criminal side. We're going to have all hands on deck to focus on crime. So I'm going to reshuffle personnel. I'm going to reshuffle priorities. Thirdly, the issues we focus on, I believe in accountability. But for some of the nonviolent, low-level offenses, we overcriminalize that. So I believe in also at the same time reducing the footprint of mass incarceration by not overcriminalizing low-level, nonviolent offenses such as people who are homeless, people who have addictions, people who have mental illnesses. We overcriminalize that. So, sorry, I wish I could give you. I never run for office. I know people on the campaign said, Jarvis, you got to do 15-second sound bites. Well, I wish the solutions were 15 seconds.
Mm-hmm. And don't worry, you're sounding fine right now. And the reality is that none of these issues are 15-second issues. And they shouldn't be 15. Sure. These shouldn't be 15-second issues because we are dealing with a lot of issues there. You talk a lot about the crime issue, and that's obviously a big problem there. And obviously some of that is going to be in regards to Mayor Fry. He's got to get out there and he's got to, you know, it's his responsibility to get those police numbers back up. But the reality is talking about accountability. We do have a problem here at times with police that seem to be to a point out of control. After George Floyd, we've had the Stallings case that came on out, where not only did they attack Stallings with unjustification and beat him in the street, but then they prosecuted him for a crime they clearly he did not commit, and they knew he hadn't committed because they saw the body cam footage. You have the Amir Locke shooting, the no-knock warrants there. you know, talk a little bit about that, because, I mean, that is the other side of it. As you say, you know, there are two sides to these stories. On one side, you do have a crime issue. You've got to talk about that. But how about the accountability when it comes to making sure the policing there is there to protect and serve, as opposed to, in some cases, abuse?
Okay. Yes, sir. I really love and appreciate you asking me how you paired the two. Yes, we need safe streets, but we also got to treat people with dignity and respect and fairly. This is my position on that, and it's multi-layered, but I'll do it very succinctly. I'll try my best. One, I believe the overwhelming majority of police want to keep us safe and go home safely to their family. My brother and sister, first-generation inner-city Chicago police officers. I've never known any police officers who I like other than my brother and sister before now. And when I said I don't know any I like, I didn't know any on a personal level. So I think a lot of them want to do the work, but there is absolutely people on the street talk about snitching. Well, the police culture has the same culture. Even though I believe the overwhelming majority of police officers want to do well, and they know who the bad officers are, they don't snitch either on each other. There's a blue wall. You never cross that. So it's a whole culture. You got to, I don't know, you can 5% bad apples, 3%, 10, 15, you name it. But the other 80% that are silent. So that's one. Two, as an African-American male growing up in the inner city of Chicago, I know what it means to be walking down the street, minding my business, and harassed by police officers. Right now, I told the audience yesterday we're at a debate. One of the candidates was saying there's no problem with culture. And I explained to him, this one is candidate. I said, if I take off my bow tie and my suit right now and go in Minneapolis, even though I was president of the state bar, Hennepin County bar, never got in trouble in my life, it's a good chance I will be treated like a suspect first when police officers drive by and pull me over, because I'll look just like all the other black folks out there. Now, we folks know that to be true. Driving while black and being treated like a suspect first until we prove ourselves innocent. Okay, that's nice, Jarvis. We know the part. So what do I say? One, the only way the reason the police, one is a cultural thing with the police department. I can't change that. But I can, as a prosecutor, not bring some of these charges we know on their face lack credibility. A lot of times the prosecutor, because they want to keep good relationships with the police department, they bring these minor bogus charges. On their face, they're minor bogus charges. That's my view. But the problem is these young men end up with records. Long term, the more they keep being brought in the system by these minor type of charges, they add up. And all of a sudden, they're treated differently. Secondly, I'm putting in place, I know Keith Ellison well. I know all these folks well, but I'm not. My job is to handle these cases by the police department. So I'm creating an independent internal investigation unit that will investigate police officer misconduct. And it'll be staffed with only senior attorneys who manage folks who does not have a day-to-day relationship with the police officer, because I don't believe anyone is above the law. So I know both sides, law. In a nutshell, law, most of them want to do their job, but I know also the law enforcement often treats, I ain't saying all of them, you take your percentage, 1%, 20%, often treat people of color in the community as second-class citizens, and we got to stop that. Mm-hmm. That's my answer, sir.
Jarvis Jones joining us, a candidate for Hennepin County attorney. It is Hennepin County here. Let's talk about one of the things I want the candidates to talk about is the rest of the county as well. I mean, there's obviously a lot of focus on Minneapolis and what's going on there. But talk about the role throughout the rest of the county. What are some of the issues there that you want to make sure you would address as the Hennepin County attorney?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I've been in this community as an assistant graduating from St. Olaf. And I've been out there canvassing, talking to folks all over Hennepin County, not just Minneapolis, you're right. And what my message is, we got to have safe streets, whether that's in Minneapolis or Edina. But one of the things that caught my attention is there's been crime in Minneapolis for quite some time. And we thought, as long we didn't like it being in Minneapolis, but we threw up our hands, what can we do? But as long as it stayed there, we were unhappy with it, but what can we do? All of a sudden, I started seeing in the Star Tribune every other day this year an article about crime. I was just reading the headlines. My wife reads the whole thing. I just look at it quickly in the morning. I'm like, what's going on? So finally, I started reading it, and it's about, why is it in the paper every other day now? Because it's crime that has spread out to the suburbs. I say that to say, carjacking, et cetera. Folks in the suburbs, what I'm finding, their number one concern is the same as folks in Minneapolis. And so my message to them is, we, when I say neighborhood, I didn't just say Minneapolis neighborhood. We are going to make sure we're going to do everything we can to reduce crime in all neighborhoods. And how do I do that? Everyone says that. This is one of the keys. When I say we can't, unless we build trust and confidence in Minneapolis, we cannot have safe streets in the surrounding suburbs. We have to. One of the things I bring is many of these troubled young men, we know it's troubled young men, particularly in Minneapolis and many of our diverse community. I don't need a translator to go into the community and speak to these young men and to speak to community leaders. That's home for me. When I go back, all my family still live in Chicago. When I go back to Chicago, home to the inner city of Chicago, I'm back home. And so when I'm in talking, I'm at a church, Zion Baptist Church this Sunday. I'm at home. And so we got to build that trust. And still, I'm going to make unpopular decisions with that community, with certain community, because when I say what the law officer did was justified, people are going to be upset. But I will have been in that community on a weekly basis, which I view as part of my job, building that trust, building that relationship. So when I say law enforcement did the right thing, there'll still be some people who call me a traitor or whatever. But I can go back there and explain it because I have built the relationships. That's what's missing from a lot of these other folks who got Scandinavian names. Nothing wrong with that. I went to St. Olaf, so I love Scandinavian. They don't, it's difficult for them to go in there and walk in the same shoes and build the trust that I know I can build.
Jarvis Jones, once again, candidate for Hennepin County Attorney. Now, here's a little bit of information for everyone out there. The primary that comes up is not going to be like a traditional primary you see where it's one party versus the other. All the candidates will be on the ballot. The top two vote getters on August 9th, we'll face off on the general election in November. If you would like more information about Jarvis Jones, his candidacy for Hennepin County Attorney, Jarvis, what's the website so people should find out all the information they can about you?
Jarvis Jones gonna win. No, I'm kidding. www.JarvisJones, J-A-R-V-I-S, J-O-N-E-S, for Hennepin.com. So Jarvis Jones to Hennepin.com. I need some bridge builders who want to bring this community together. Please go there, volunteer. We need people canvassing. If you like what I'm saying, and we're going to do it together. Amen.
If you'd like to volunteer or like to donate, once again, it's Jarvis Jones for Hennepin.com, Jarvis Jones for Hennepin.com. I'll spotlight this interview and we'll make sure we link to everything a little bit later on. Jarvis, thank you very much. I appreciate the time today.
And thank you, sir. I appreciate you giving me an audience.
By all means. Jarvis Jones, a candidate for Hennepin County Attorney, candidate of the day. We'll take a break and finish up the hour when we do return. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. We've gotten so far quite a few of the Hennepin County Attorney candidates on. We'll you know, obviously if they want to get on the air, we'll make time for them before the primary. And once again, the primary works differently for them. It's the top two vote getters on August 9th. They move to the general election. All right. So find out. We've had them on. You can go listen to the podcast on SoundCloud, iTunes. Just pull up the Hennepin County Attorney's races. You'll find them all in there. Okay. We had mentioned that if you commit a crime in Edina, that.
Yes, if you commit a crime in Edina, repeat, McNeil, keep blubbering.
Oh, it's Edina guy. Hi, Edina guy. How are you doing?
Fine. My boy Reginald is looking forward to his next school year. I'm trying to teach him now to how to be respectful of those people that make less money than us. Hello there, Reginald. Yes, no. No more throwing jarts at the help. All right, thank you.
All right, Edina guy. Well, you are you bothered at all by the fact that there's cameras everywhere in Edina?
Of course not. I'm a beautiful person. The beautiful people like cameras looking at us everywhere we go.
Really?
Yeah. Yes, yes. Shall I pose for you? Oh, if you follow me on Instagram, I am a delight. Ooh, look at my thighs. They shine. Ooh.
All right, Edina guy. I'm going to let you go off and stop Reginald from going out there and tormenting your staff there, okay? All right, just off you go. I did say there are cameras everywhere in Edina. There are cameras everywhere in Edina. If you commit a crime in Edina, they are going to know exactly who you are. And here's the thing, I just want to make sure you understand this. Say, I'm going to run away. They won't catch me. They got cameras every freaking block, dude. So they will know you where you've went better than you did. And if you just think that's Edina, there's tons of cameras around Minneapolis, St. Paul. Unless you've got one of those, you know, mole person cars that goes underground, they're going to find, or a plane. Now that would be a gutsy robbery. Rob someone, jump in a plane, take a, I mean, you'd have to steal a lot because the gas guy's price for your plane. Plus, you know, it's not easy parking in a grocery store parking lot. So they're going to find you. If you commit a crime in Edina, they're going to find you. Police in Edina are looking to identify a teenage boy who may have information about the incident in which a noose was hung in the community center this last week. The city of Edina provided more details of the incident on Tuesday, which saw an Edina public school staff member find a noose harnessed to an implement in the building's roof and hung in one of the courtyards in Edina Community Center, 5701 West Frontage Road. The discovery was reported to police with the noose removed. In an update Wednesday, Edina Police Department says surveillance video from Monday and Tuesday prior to the noose being placed shows a white teenage boy near the scene. The boy was wearing black Vans hoodie, dark shorts, tall socks, black slip-on canvas tennis shoes, and carrying a backpack. Police are looking for the boy to come forward or anyone who might know to call them. The finding in the noose was swiftly condemned by the Edina Public Schools superintendent, Dr. Stacy Stanley, who said a noose is a horrendous symbol long known for its intimidation, harm, and violence against Black and African Americans, and more recently towards other non-dominant groups. We stand against racism and condemn hate. These events are painful, not only for those targeted, but for everyone in our community who values diversity and inclusivity, working towards change. So, I mean, if you haven't seen the images, I'll link the story a little bit later on the social media pages, on Matt McNeil Show on Twitter and Progressive Citizen X Matt McNeil Show on Facebook. Take a look. If you, my guess is someone's going to identify this kid. Someone's going to identify this kid, and we're going to know exactly what. At least I should say he might just have information, or he might not have any information. But we'll find out who the kid is. I guarantee you that. And if you think about trying to pull off these crimes, I guarantee you right now, Edina is getting their cameras. If they're going to be looking at every single one. There's just been enough of that. Enough with the hate. Just don't be a jerk, okay? Devil Radio coming up next. Native Roots Radio coming up at 6. We are back tomorrow. Till then, see ya.